You're listening to This Month in HIV, the body's monthly podcast discussion about the latest, most important developments in HIV. For more information on this podcast, including a full transcript, visit us on the web at www.thebody.com/HIVmonth.
Hello, this is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of The Body. I'd like to welcome you to This Month in HIV. Today's topic, tips and tricks for coping with HIV. A psychotherapist and three HIV-positive people share their wisdom. Being diagnosed with HIV can be one of the most traumatic experiences in a person's life. Whether you're 15 or 55, the emotions that come with an HIV diagnosis can be overwhelming, as can the millions of questions, small and large, that start shooting through your mind. Questions like, how could this have happened to me? How will my life change? Who should I tell? Will anyone still love me? Will I have to take treatment for the rest of my life? We brought together an expert on HIV and mental health and three people, all of whom have been living with HIV for more than 10 years. They'll offer concrete tips for coping with HIV. Our first guest is Dr. Robert Remyan, a prominent HIV researcher and clinical psychologist based in New York City. His research focuses on mental health and support for people with HIV, including work with mixed-status couples and gay men. Welcome, Dr. Remyan.
Thank you.
Larry Bryant is a semi-pro football player turned HIV-positive political activist, a 20-year survivor of HIV. Larry is now the national field organizer for the HIV advocacy group Housing Works in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Larry.
Welcome, and thank you for inviting me.
Sherry Lewis lives in Los Angeles and speaks out about HIV in her podcast series, Straight Girl in a Queer World, hosted by Here TV, a gay television network. She's also a performer and writer who's been living with HIV since 1987. Welcome, Sherry.
Hi.
Michael McCauley is a Chicago-based author, writing instructor, and yoga teacher. He recently published his memoir, The After Death Room, Journey into Spiritual Activism. Michael tested positive for HIV in 1996. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, everyone.
Thank you all for being here. Let's start with what may be the most challenging moment in the life of someone diagnosed with HIV, the days and weeks and months following the initial diagnosis. Dr. Remy, let's start with you. I know you've facilitated groups for people who have just been diagnosed. What do you think is the biggest issue for someone just diagnosed? And what would you say are the most helpful coping tips for someone during this traumatic time?
Well, I think across the board for most people, it's initially the emotional shock, the shock of receiving a diagnosis. And that's whether someone suspected they already have it or not. I think when the news is made concrete and made real, emotionally, there's a shock factor that people deal with. Ironically, for some people, but I wouldn't want to, you know, sensationalize this, for some people, it's a bit of a relief. If they've been really, really worried and been thinking for so long they're going to get it or thought it was only eventual that they would get it, some people have talked about there being, well, okay, now I know what I'm dealing with. It's been made real. But I think for the majority of people, there is an emotional shock. And psychologically, unfortunately, even though there are effective treatments and we speak about it as being a chronic disease, it still is true that it's a life-threatening illness, and people initially feel a tremendous loss of hope, feeling like it's the end of the world and their life is going to change in so many ways, which is true on one hand, but people need to realize they can have a normal life back. I think the most important thing in terms of coping is, I like to really emphasize with people initially, that they need to know that dealing with the diagnosis and coming to terms with it will take time. And they need to give themselves time to feel a whole range of feelings. Their emotions will fluctuate over time, especially initially. And they need to know that eventually this HIV diagnosis is going to move from the very front of their brain to the back burner. It never goes away, but it becomes less primary. And over time, it gets integrated into their life and they start to feel a little bit more normal. But I would emphasize initially, in the meantime, what people need to do initially is get information, find support, which is different things for different people. For some people, it's friends. It could be family. It could be a professional. It could be turning to one's faith and spirituality. I think for a lot of people, what's very supportive is just being able to speak to other people who are living with HIV, whether that be in a group or just one-on-one. And the caution I would put out there, and I often do with people I counsel, is there's no need to disclose broadly and to feel like they've got to run out and do everything to take care of this. Think about what would be most helpful for you in the immediate term, and other things will happen over time. But initially, at least be able to speak to one person. Not everyone's a group person. Not everyone wants to talk to everyone about it. And people have a right to be private about this, but don't isolate themselves and turn to someone that is supportive to them.
Great advice. Larry, what are your thoughts? What was the biggest issue for you when you were diagnosed?
The biggest issue for me when I was diagnosed was how I was going to die. I mean, I was, you know, diagnosed in the 80s. Obviously, it's a lot different. The climate is a little bit different than to be diagnosed, say, you know, in 2007, 2008. But at the time, along with my HIV diagnosis, I was given a date that I was going to die. I was told I had 9 years to live. So, you know, as an 18-year-old, all the life plans, all the long-term planning that you have, you know, sitting in the back of the classroom, you know, writing out, you know, this is what kind of car I'm going to drive. This is what kind of house I'm going to live in. You know, I was playing football at the time, which was my goal to be in the NFL. I was going to marry Halle Berry, you know, all the things that we think we're going to do. You know, you ball it up and you throw it away. It took a lot of time for me to kind of come to grasp with living beyond today. And, you know, it's the best and worst thing that can happen is that you stop and smell the roses because you start appreciating things, but you don't necessarily look down the road because you realize there's roses down there. And, you know, fast forward here, I'm you know, going on 22 years positive, and I'm still in the process of trying to grasp the whole long-term deal. So just living each day is a must, but sometimes when you concentrate too much on the day, you kind of forget that, hey, we're going to be here for a while. And, you know, so it's just the world has been shaken. You try to remain on your feet. You try, you know, to make sure the ground doesn't move anymore. And it's difficult. And like the doctor said, I mean, each individual kind of processes and copes in very, very different and distinct ways. You know, and if at all, you know, some of us don't.
Sherry, you were diagnosed during the same time period as Larry. So what were you, and you also felt that it was a death sentence, or were told it was a death sentence at the time. So what were some of your, you know, techniques for dealing with it?
Oh, well, I was told over the telephone, and when I heard the news, the first thing that happened is I literally dropped to my knees, and having just witnessed and buried two of my closest friends to AIDS, I knew what it looked like, and I could only, you know, that was the pictures that kept running, flashing in front of my eyes was, you know, I was going to die, and that's what I was going to look like, and when is this going to happen? I mean, just sheer terror just ran, you know, 100 miles an hour speeding through my mind. And I prayed. I'm not a religious person, especially at that time, but I was in a recovery program for alcohol and drugs, and part of that program was, you know, a spiritual connection and prayer. And so I'm fortunate that I hit my knees and I started to pray that God would get me through this, and that I didn't feel I was getting punished. I knew that God was going to give me the strength to get through it. That is how I coped with every breath I took, and it was one breath at a time. I really was horrified. I was also 3 months away from my wedding date, which is why I asked to be tested, because I was in my early 30s, wanted to get pregnant. And I did what, you know, we tell so many women of childbearing years to do today is, you know, get tested so you can spare the life of your child from having HIV. And we didn't even have information about women. I just knew I didn't want to have an AIDS baby if that were, you know, if I'm by chance I was positive, and I didn't think I was because I had no symptoms. And, you know, for me, it changed everything. I was terrified that I infected my fiancé. I was terrified he'd leave me at the altar. My fiancé was a single parent. I was afraid I might have killed this boy's only parent.
So how did you cope?
I had a support system in a 12-step fellowship. I went directly to a meeting. So I was lucky there was a support system in place. I went there and I took direction from, you know, what we call in the programs in the rooms of recovery, a sponsor. She said, you need to go to a meeting, you need to talk about it, and then talk about the solution, how you're not going to pick up a drink or a drug today. And so that's exactly what I did. I just marched forward. And you can imagine there was a gasp in the air when I said I just tested positive, and I was in Boston, Massachusetts. Nobody said any, you know, this wasn't something you would say anywhere, let alone there. And the, you could hear, you know, a pin drop, literally. And after the meeting, people just hugged me and said, you're going to be okay. And no doctor could tell me I was going to be okay. But those hands that hugged me, that loved me, that didn't treat me like I was a leper or that any idea I had like wheatgrass or acupuncture was weird, they all said, that sounds good, you know, like, you know. That's how I coped. I went to meetings. I found a phenomenal therapist who was specializing in people with life-threatening illnesses, and her waiting room was filled with young men with, you know, oxygen tanks on their backs, you know, portable oxygen tanks. And I was the only woman in the waiting room, and they were obviously in much worse shape than I was. So the thing that I did is I kind of, a tool, fake it till you make it, that I was going to survive this. I was pissed, and I think it worked for me. How dare this happen to me at this time in my life? How dare that, you know, this is not for me. I'm not signing up for this. I just had the audacity, you know, it's like Obama says, the audacity of hope. I did. I felt like this is not acceptable, and I will go to any lengths to overcome this, and I did. I mean, from diet to prayer to lifestyle and helping others, so I didn't think about me 24/7 because I was too afraid to think about me and my future.
Mm-hmm. So how often did you go to support groups?
Every day, sometimes twice a day.
And how long did you continue doing that?
Well, I still do it. It's 22 plus years later. Not as often, but I have a program of prayer, service, and meetings.
Michael, last but not least, can you share with us when you were first diagnosed, some of the ways you coped?
Well, you know, in listening to everyone, you know, I'm kind of both reminding myself of all the things that that people told me, and all the emotions that are still kind of bubbling up now after kind of hearing how people responded. So I think that it's, as Dr. Rimian mentioned, there is a variety of feelings that you have, and I think now, in retrospect, I remember being very nervous about having the right emotions, and I think you do go through a lot of different types of emotions, and you need to really savor the emotions. I was very angry, as Sherry was, and as Larry mentioned about having a plan in my life and how that was going to be changed and why was this going to happen to me. But I think the thing that I want to sort of emphasize to people is that there's a lot of energy that happens when you find out, the doctor mentioned shock, and the body does respond emotionally, psychologically, and physiologically. And I think using that energy to kind of start changing, as Sherry mentioned, and start doing things that you kind of know you need to do. And it was a jolt for me to kind of move on with my life, and I went after things that I suppose I was sort of dragging my feet on, which is recovery. I was dealing with addiction problems, with my own writing, and being more conscious and open about my own sexuality, being a bisexual. I had to face a lot of things about myself, and it was hard, but I think I began to use the energy, and of course I used my creativity, and I also had been practicing yoga and I really latched on to my spiritual practice and the community of yoga teachers and friends that I had.
I think all these answers are wonderful, and what you hear is you hear commonalities across people's stories, but it's also for listeners to realize that they'll have some of their own unique emotional response, you know, as was just reinforced by Michael, that there's a range of feelings that people have, and people need to give themselves permission to feel whatever they feel and to give themselves space and time to feel those feelings. And you can also see that people find support in different ways. So what people need to think about what works for them, but the important thing is that they not isolate themselves and that they do reach out to others and realize, again, as everyone has told in their story, that there is this is a lifelong thing that people are dealing with, but they do regain hope. The human spirit is amazingly resilient, and people need to know that no matter how they feel in the beginning, they will be able to live, you know, with hope and good quality of life, and just know that that will happen with time. But find the support that is unique to them.
I wanted to talk about another thing that is very important, and that's telling others about your diagnosis. And I guess if we would imagine the weeks and the months after testing positive are rough, another rough moment comes when you have to tell others, because you're kind of reliving your diagnosis all over again. So, Dr. Redman, how do you counsel people to tell others, and when do you think is a good time?
Well, what you first said is absolutely true, that people do relive their HIV initial diagnosis when they go through disclosures in different contexts, in different places. It brings up all those feelings, even if it's 20 years later. I think the theme you'll hear from me is these things happen over time, and they happen in specific contexts. One size does not fit all. And there's no just one rule on disclosure. Disclosure is important so that people aren't isolated. But people will need to balance the cost and benefit of disclosing in certain contexts and thinking about people's need to know versus their right to know and their need to know my diagnosis. So people need to be given permission to disclose at times and at times not to disclose because it's a private matter. So timing depends on the context, the person, and the environment within which one is disclosing. I think for a lot of people where it's very, very challenging, of course, is in dating and intimacy and in relationships. But I always say that, you know, HIV is just one characteristic of a person among many that intimate people get to know over time. So it really depends on the specific circumstance. You know, with disclosure can come a lot of support and a lot of benefits, but people also need to be, you know, aware that they are opening themselves up to vulnerabilities, such as rejection and, unfortunately, discrimination in some contexts.
I wanted to ask you, Larry, about a little bit about disclosure, because I know you were silent for 20 years before you decided to disclose. And I read something you wrote about silence takes a lot of energy. And I thought that was interesting. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was 5 years after my initial diagnosis. It was 5 years before I told anyone. I mean, the first person I told was my mom. And it was kind of a release. I mean, I don't remember everything about the moment because I completely let it go. You know, and the silence, I mean, the energy that it takes to, well, it depends on where you are. I mean, you're talking about the stigma and the fear, the ignorance that surrounds us a lot of times, and it comes in different shapes, forms, and sizes. The world we live in, you know, I attended a historically black university. I was playing football at the time, you know. I'm straight, and I was diagnosed at a time where even the CDC came out and said it was a gay disease, predominantly in white communities. So my own absorbing of that kind of, you know, it took energy to do that itself, to talk about even now in 2007, about to be 2008, in communities, whether it's me or anyone, disclosing your status automatically opens up the topic of, okay, well, is he gay or how or what happened? You know, what bad happened? What did he do? What did she do? Mm-hmm. And a lot of that, before we even disclose, whether it's in a personal setting or, you know, in some cases when you're doing public speaking in a group setting, you know, there's still that interior mechanism within my head that kind of relays, that kind of goes out ahead of the conversation and kind of and tries to see if I can predict what the reaction of people are going to be. You know, being a black man and being positive, I think, is unique in the sense that, you know, being a black man, there's all the other kind of stereotypes and discriminatory type of things that even we place in ourselves. I mean, just for example, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, you know, we all know Sean Taylor, the football player, got shot. I had a discussion with someone, and we're thinking, well, it's a black man, you know, an employed black man in bed, in his own bed, alone at 2 o'clock in the morning, is shot. And the first thing that the media and everyone asks is, what did he do? So, I mean, that mindset exists in the same way with HIV and AIDS. When we're diagnosed, now the very graphic and public deaths that we see on the front of newspapers and magazines and heard about back in the 80s and early 90s don't exist anymore. But what we have are people who die an emotional, a spiritual, and a cultural death long before the physical one comes.
Yep.
And just to stay afloat, just to stay sane, just to stay healthy, and for the most part, just to stay human, you know, it takes a lot of energy just to keep that sanity and try to develop our own coping tools if they're available for us.
Larry, I wanted to go back to you just for one second. So 5 years after your diagnosis, you told your mom, and then you came out publicly after 20 years, and what was that like? And why did you decide to do that?
Well, the goal wasn't to necessarily come out publicly. I mean, I didn't aspire to be on a magazine or, you know, all these things that I've been on at this point. But I think what we want to be able to, the ultimate message we want people to have who are newly diagnosed, who are long-term survivors, who are, and still, again, in this two, almost three decades into an epidemic, who are still much more willing at times to die at home behind locked doors under their bed than to live one day as an HIV positive person, is just that. You know, I don't want to come out. It wasn't a thing of me coming out with a megaphone and saying, I'm positive, look at me. There was a sense of, yes, my name is Larry Bryant, I'm HIV positive, and this is my message, and this is my life. And being able to, you know, we as HIV positive people have to be the ones that address the idea of stigma and fear. It's not, you can't legislate anti-stigma, you can't mandate anti-discrimination, I mean, you can, but you can't, you know, morally it's not happening, realistically it's not going to happen. So we have to be the ones that take a hold of our own life. And, you know, we have to swim. We have to swim because the life raft isn't always going to come when you want it to, and it may not always look like what you hope it to look like. So it's just my way of kind of regaining consciousness, being flatlined for, you know, over 10 years and kind of having that silence of not, you know, being scared to speak, being scared to disclose. I had to restart my heart and restart my life by just being me. And that includes, you know, a part of that means being an HIV positive black man living in America.
Wow. Michael, can you talk to that a little bit about disclosing and when you first disclosed to people?
Well, I just want to say that Larry's story is very inspiring to me. And you sound like you have a lot of wisdom. And I think that it's a hard journey. And I think that sometimes we look back and we tell the story easily, but it's a painful step-by-step journey. And by trying to be yourself, as Larry said, is really a very good advice. It was hard for me to disclose because I hadn't dealt with my sexual life. So that was a kind of a double thing going on. And as I'm sure Dr. Rumian would agree, is that when you do disclose to people, family, friends, or in a public place, as Larry was talking about, you are addressing people's fears, their deep fears. And in my case, it was fears about sexuality. It obviously fears about illness, fears about death, fears about stigma. You know, it is a social disease that we are responding to, as Larry so eloquently said, and we have to be conscious of that when we are talking to people, is that there's a lot of projection on us, and that can be doubly hard. I mean, just like people who deal with cancer, diabetes, anything else, when they tell people about it, you know, they have to be prepared for the the emotional responses of the people that they tell, and that can be a double shock, and that can produce anger and sadness, because here you are having going through all that you're going through, and then you're actually feeling physically the kind of fear and emotional response of the person or the group of people. I've spoken around the country with my book, and people come up afterwards and they're crying about the fact that they just found out about cancer or anything, because they see you as this person who has gone through a lot, and that in some ways my ego is like a massage, but on the other hand, I had to and still have to cope with all the emotions that come towards me, and I'm sure Sherry responds the same way with performing and being out there as a symbol. We have to find ways to kind of keep ourselves sane, like Larry was saying, because it can be traumatic to sort of embody other people's fears. So I watch out, you have to keep building yourself up and find ways to keep yourself sane and not take on the world, which I have tried a few times.
And that's such an important point. I think what everyone's saying is that there clearly are benefits with when people do disclose over time and the support they can get, but at the same time, there are times where it can add extra burdens. And so I think particularly when people are in the early stages of dealing with this, that they need to give themselves time and think about, is this supportive of me at this point in time to share this news with this particular person in my life? Because as Michael was just saying, you're left with having to take care of them, and that may be fine when you're a little more stabilized yourself, but initially that can be a little bit more of a burden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was reluctant to be public. I was very happy to stay in a support group. I really did. I just wanted to be with friends and family, go to my doctor, go to my therapist, and cope. A woman was actually following me for several months. She had a grant to do a program about HIV. It was called Passing It On, and it was a theatrical prevention education theater piece. And that happened for a couple of years before I finally said yes, after I asked her, where does this go? And she said, don't worry, it's like public schools. And we went to, middle schools and high schools, 8 o'clock in the morning assemblies. And I thought, oh, this is great. You're really anonymous. One day, there was a network there, a local television station, and unbeknownst to me, that was recording the whole thing. And afterwards, I said, I'm not public about this. And she said, well, it's so inspiring. And I said, I prefer you not put this on the news. And that night on the 10 o'clock news in Boston, there it was. And it had my face and her soundbite for 2.5 minutes over my story, which, wasn't a full story, of course. And it had my name, Sherry L., like, oh, that's helpful. I mean, and I was absolutely horrified. And my therapist called the woman and said, you're lucky she's not suicidal. I mean, this is a terrible thing. And, I really did go back to prayer again, and what is the meaning in this? And I thought, maybe God is trying to tell me that it's time to be more public, because I realized then you can't be on a public stage and talk about HIV and then say, but it's not public, for public consumption. So I ended up working with a writer on the Boston Globe who said she would tell my story complete, and it hit World AIDS Day, the front page of the Leisure and Arts section in the Boston Globe called Stage Fright. She did a beautiful job writing the story. From then on, I met with the mayor in Boston, Tom Menino, and before I knew it, I was really, really out.
But Sherry, tell me, did you have good disclosure stories and bad disclosure stories, I mean, since going public?
Well, public was wonderful. I mean, I lived in the same my neighbors were amazing. I lived in the same building for 12 years. I got notes under my doors and flowers about we always knew you were a success, but not this kind of success. I found, as the doctor said, in my disclosure, I did not anticipate so much love and embrace. And that was my experience for all those years back east.
So disclosure is pretty loaded. But Sherry, did you all have good family reactions then?
My brother and stuff was not so great. My sister-in-law didn't want me in my hometown talking about it because that's where they lived and they went to school. I didn't find it so great. Really, my support is through my mother, God bless her. And I have a niece that's been very active in her early school years with AIDS programs in her public school.
So, Dr. Rubin, do you find that people will tell one relative and not another, or?
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think the message is that people should be feel they have permission to do that, as you're hearing in these stories. And I think Sherry's giving some great examples where it can be supportive and it can be not so supportive. And unfortunately, you know, even though we're 25 years into the epidemic, we still face that kind of stigma and rejection. You know, and I encourage people when they're considering disclosure to think about who they want to tell and why, and how it will benefit them, how it might cost them, and to make decisions accordingly. And I think it's fine for people to tell certain family members and not others, just like in certain friendship groups.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give an example, I've often heard people talk about an aging parent or a grandparent, and they go, well, you know, I'm not sure what this person's going to do with the information. I don't need this person to know, and I don't want to burden them, and I'm just going to have to take care of their emotional reaction. So sometimes they'll say, you know what, there's no real good reason to tell that particular person.
Mm-hmm. I think it also takes a different level of thought process when you're going down that list of who should I tell and why and who shouldn't I tell and why.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think sometimes who we suspect might be the worst, you know, who would take it worst, turns out to be someone that is very supportive and vice versa.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
There are people in all reality, there are people that work in the field who are trained at working with illness and disease, who are sometimes have their own fear and stigmas that exist that are openly, you know, present in just mere discussions. I've talked to people who have, you know, who have moved states, you know, because of a comment a nurse or someone in their waiting room has given to them, you know, dealing with, you know, an HIV positive person. I think it takes a special kind of allowance on ourselves to not automatically label who to tell, who not to, it's a very, very personal choice, but I don't think we should shut ourselves off completely. I mean, there are people who are diagnosed positive, who are HIV positive, who feel that they can only date HIV positive people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, there are people, you know, who will, I mean, and that limits, you know, their hopes, their dreams, and everything else, you know, beyond that. So I think it just takes an extra level of kind of a thought process and of acceptance of ourselves to be able to open up in that sense.
I want to say, too, that it may also provide an opportunity to become very close to people. This, of course, takes a lot of emotional energy, but there, you know, we live in sort of isolation all the time. I mean, we all do in various ways in this country. And when you open yourself up and become vulnerable in front of others, there's a deep relief among people who see in you the chance to be, as Larry said before, human. You know, I mean, I became closer to my parents and my sisters and some other friends. And like Larry said, there's sometimes a surprise. There's a friend or somebody you don't really, you think will be really supportive, and they're not. And then there's another person that you think, oh, man, maybe that person. And then they turn out to be this deeply connected person to you. And so it's a surprise, but it can be a beautiful surprise.
Right. I mean, I understand and respect, you know, decision-making process that goes towards, you know, to whom you disclose to and who not. But we deny ourselves the opportunity to develop a certain level of, mm-hmm. of self-respect and bravery, you know, in just living with the disease and just talking about it in our own, you know, in the context of the I statement. And it also denies other individuals the opportunity to be educated, to be absorbed, and to understand the complexities that are the life of an HIV-positive person.
It also depends where you are in life. As I was married and I had that part of my life secured, mm-hmm. and I had a support system in 12-step fellowship, that I was able to disclose without feeling like, you know, I had a foundation and a world around me that gave me the strength to be able to speak out and be out. Everything changes, and, you know, over 15 years later, well over that, I still have my support system, but I'm single, and I've relocated, so the friends are relatively new, but I have good, solid relationships. But it makes it much more difficult, and I'm having to practice not being so upfront about HIV, because my therapist will say to me, why don't you give him a chance to get to know who you are first? Because it's not exactly a date maker. And, you know, that's been work for me. It's an exercise.
Let's discuss now finding love when you have HIV and what that's about. Larry, can you start? So it's about disclosure, but it's also about feeling that you deserve to find love. There have been polls of HIV-positive people who have decided to be abstinent because they didn't want to deal with all that comes with dating.
Well, and then there are people that decide to be abstinent because of regardless of your status, of all that comes with dating.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times when we're diagnosed and we see ourselves, you know, we accept the life, you know, willingly or unwillingly of being an HIV-positive person, that kind of knocks us outside of the normal orbit of the dating scene. I was diagnosed at 18 on a college campus as a football player. You know, I'm in the middle or at least at the beginning of my dating life or whatever and never really experienced it because I just automatically subtracted myself from the equation. And over time, it's like I'm Haley's Comet. You know, I feel like I should be dating maybe every 6 or 7 years. And then even then, it's tricky. But
where are you now? Are you coming back in?
I think I'm in the Aquarian line of the stars. I'm not sure.
Good.
But it's being able to, I mean, I think first of all, and it's easier said than done, but we have to understand that dating in general is tricky. And it takes a kind of a special skill of listening and understanding who we are as people. You know, and what do we bring to a relationship? Like I said, it's easier said than done, but being able to accept ourselves and knowing what we want as an individual first, knowing who we are as an individual, what our needs are, what our wants are, what our desires are, and then after that, deciding, okay, what is it that I want? Because there's no way, positive or negative, that you're going to be able to identify love if you don't know where the map leads and you don't know what your needs are. Because there you know, you talk about this vulnerability that we put ourselves in disclosing, and when you have yourself in a vulnerable state, sometimes you're easily swayed to the first person that, you know, gives you a sympathetic hug, and that, again, positive or negative, may not always be the best thing. So I think the first part is just understanding who we are as people, where we are, what we need to be, what kind of happiness we need, what kind of likes, who we are, and then have a sense of what we want and who we want. And if we're truly serious about that relationship, when you have all those things in place, I think once you meet someone that it's easier to identify those qualities within that person if we already know what we want. But what we do, I think, whether it's on purpose or whether it's just kind of a self-conscious act, is that we feel like we have to prove ourselves. We already hope, as a guy especially, we already hope that the woman likes us. You know, you go back to in grade school or in high school when, you know, you have the school dances in the gym and all the guys are standing up on the one side and all the girls are standing up on the other side, and you have to be that one guy that walks all the way across the gym to ask, and chances are you're going to get disappointed. It's just like, how and how fast and how would I look going back by myself? Those same fears exist now, only that we dress up in this bright red suit. You know, like, you know, the ultimate scarlet letter when we go out on a date, and we feel kind of overly self-conscious at times because we kind of put out a preemptive strike, you know, and then we may not even give ourselves the total chance or the best of chances because we expect to fail. Mm-hmm. With the added weight of the diagnosis of the HIV status.
Women have the same feelings of rejection and will he like me, and talk about a scarlet letter. Women are so much more accepting of men who are positive. That's been my experience.
Wait, question. You said in your perspective, women are much easier to accept.
Women have been, in my experience, my friend has been dating and been in relationships, all with negative women, and they have all been extremely loving, long relationships, several years, even looking at, you know, the possibilities of getting pregnant or having a family. I mean, really invested, supportive, loving, caring, nurturing, all of those things. A man does not go that, my experience has gone that distance. My ex-husband did, but the problem for us was not being able to have children, and it was just really painful. And then me being an activist, you know, the stigma of coming out and, you know, looking at him publicly, people looking at him, and he was in the community, pretty out in the community, not about HIV, but just in general, and people looking at him wondering, like, does he have it, or did he get it from her? Did she, you know? So that broke our marriage up, and he wasn't positive.
I'm not going to say you're wrong, but I know in the black community and a lot of communities that I've been part of, it's much more the other way around. Because mm-hmm. as a positive man, there is the trust issue mm-hmm. of, okay, there's still the stereotype of it's a gay disease, or it's close to a gay disease. So if you're positive, and you're probably gay, if not now, then at one time. Or, you know, because so many men have been, especially in the black community, people of color, have been, you know, HIV is tied very closely to being incarcerated, to having, you know, some kind of drug history. There's all of these what ifs that come mm-hmm. attached to that
diagnosis. Well, that is true. Yeah.
So it kind of lends itself of a very, very distinct distrust in yeah. who this man really is. And hell, that even goes beyond status. I mean, because of, with the whole, I know this is, I got to watch my language, but the whole book a few years ago, the whole just thing about the download
oh, yeah.
and how that, you know, just really propelled the distrust
right.
Between sexes, particularly among black couples. So every woman was looking at their man differently
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
this guy wrote a book that had these symbols. If you can tell your man is this, if you do this, and it really boils down. It has nothing to do with the whole download thing. It has nothing to do with any of those specific things individually. What it has to do with primarily is the level of trust and understanding mm-hmm. and communication. And if you have any breaks in either of those avenues, mm-hmm. then you can label it whatever you want to, and it's going to prevent the actual connection of happening.
I think it's important to comment that what I'm hearing is that, I mean, the reality is that in different settings, different communities, in different contexts, and across different people, there is a reality of there being stigma and prejudice and all kinds of everyone in their own minds, you know, thinking, well, what this must mean, why this person's HIV positive. That's
right.
Real, and that's what makes it so challenging for a lot of people, particularly when it comes to dating and finding love. But I also think the way you posed the question, Bonnie, and I think the way Larry started answering, the most important thing is that people need to feel that they have a right to love, a right to sex, a right to being a parent, to even having children when living with HIV. And all these things are, it's... Everyone has that same right, and while there are challenges to doing it, it's love is out there for people, and also, can't get into it now, but the whole issue about becoming a parent when one is living with HIV is becoming more and more of a reality for people. So people need to remember they still have a right to their sexuality and to their livelihood.
I'm in my 50s. And a lot is different in your 50s, not just HIV, but a lot of things, not just hormonally, but even, you know, dating and what's available and who wants to deal with this now. And so that's a huge cofactor, not just what years were you diagnosed, but how old were you when you were diagnosed? Where were you in terms of your life? And, you know, that's made a huge different for me.
Well, we don't have much time left. I think a lot of people just diagnosed with HIV need to hear that even though they feel that their diagnosis will be the hardest part of their journey living with HIV, mm-hmm. as a person with HIV, they face other particular challenges. And I started a little list, like dating, which we just discussed, starting treatment, which is difficult, getting tired of treatment, and dealing with the constant stigma. Dr. Emmon, do you have a list of what people should beware of or realize that these are known valleys in their life going forward as an HIV positive person?
Well, and I think you're already starting to list the appropriate ones. I mean, you know, as we're hearing throughout this conversation, there are lifelong challenges. It's not just dealing with the initial diagnosis. A lot of these things don't go away. But we're also hearing there can be really good quality of life and love in people's lives. But there are particular points that I think people find particularly emotionally challenging, such as having physical symptoms, having an illness, whether the illness be HIV-related or not. Emotionally, the feeling is, wow, what is this, and is this my spiral downward? So there's just that emotional fear whenever anyone gets sick. It's emotionally challenging when people go for their blood work, or they see all of a sudden a very high viral load that they didn't have before, or they see a change in their CD4. People shouldn't panic and freak out at just one viral load change or one CD4 change. You have to look at a pattern over time, but that's an emotionally challenging part. When people have to initiate medication, they feel like they've entered a new realm of dealing with HIV. Coping with chronic medications and long-term and the side effects, whether they be the short-term or long-term side effects, there are challenges there. You know, so constantly taking care of yourself and adhering to care and adhering to treatment. As we've been talking about stigma and disclosure and discrimination, that's not just a one-time thing. People might deal with that, you know, 20 years into their infection in a new environment or a new place. So I think all of these are examples where people may need some extra support, whether that be through a counselor, through a friend, from a group, through their faith. But these things do happen over time.
And the rising demographic of aging in HIV.
Yes, and then you got everything else that goes on with aging, as Sherry
was
saying.
I'm so tired of having to deal with... I've been living with HIV for over 22 years. Now I have to deal with bone density, hormone replacement.
Mm-hmm.
How does this affect my HIV meds? There's not a heck of a lot of information about that yet because we didn't have the luxury of thinking about aging with HIV, which is the good news today is we are aging with HIV today. And that's the good news, and, you know, it has a whole bunch of other things. But we get to hopefully bring some information with how are we living with this physically, mentally, and emotionally. And hopefully you have a spiritual connection, because I know that's been giving me the foundation of support I've needed all these years.
When you talk about adherence, I mean, it's just adhering to life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we think about the number of people that we've lost to HIV and AIDS, to this epidemic. And we automatically, you know, we talk about teachers and lawyers and doctors and artists and mothers and brothers and family members and actors and on down the line. We've lost people who have died, who have lost the battle of fighting the disease. But we've also lost a lot of people whose life emotionally ended when their diagnosis came. They stopped teaching. They automatically subtract themselves from their passions, from their dreams. And we have to remind people when they're newly diagnosed, after going through the initial shock and trauma that you know, inevitably is going to hit you one way or another, but to remember to hold on to any part of your life that you had originally. Your life doesn't change, and you're not disqualified from your dreams and your passions just because you're diagnosed HIV positive. And I think that's one thing that we want to instill in people, whether you've been diagnosed a month ago or whether you've been positive for over two decades. I think to remember those dreams and those skills, and don't subtract yourself. It's hard enough, you know, fighting the stigma and discrimination that exists outside of our own beings, but to add another ton and a half of our own weight to that is much more difficult to overcome.
That's beautifully said. And, you know, it was after 10 years that I decided to go to several other countries and write a book about how other people in South Africa and India and Thailand and even here in the United States who have, as Larry said, have shut themselves down. And that to me is still terrifying because I wrestle with it every day. But to find, you know, whatever engine keeps you going, you just got to keep reinventing it. But that's what everybody does in life anyway. You find that out. I mean, my mother tells me that all the time, and she's dealing with Alzheimer's now. And there's a new thing. We got to keep finding the strength somehow. So to think that this is a special sort of thing that's only happened to us, I mean, you have to keep fighting against that. By challenging yourself in new ways, you kind of have to wake up each day and go after a new thing, and that can be difficult, but we're all dealing with that in everyday life, and we do have strength. We just have to keep encouraging ourselves.
I'm afraid we're out of time, so thank you very much, everybody. Thank you, Dr. Remy, and thank you, Larry, Sherry, and Michael, for taking the time to share your thoughts. I think this will be a very inspiring podcast.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebody.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us. You've reached the end of this month in HIV's program. To read the transcript or let us know what you think of this program, please visit www.thebody.com/HIVmonth.